Making sure the business of herbal supplements is sustainable for the plants, the people, and the planet.
60% of the collectors in Bosnia would do something else if they had the option. So it's not a great way to make a living. And migration to urban areas and the loss of wild collection practices and the passing of that knowledge is one of the greatest threats to the long-term supply of botanicals from around the world. And so Fair Wild is one of the initiatives that's really trying to think, how do we make that livelihood better?
That's Ann Arbrecht. We spend the hour with her, first talking with her about her book, The Business of Botanicals, and later we revisit a part of our 2009 conversation with Arbrecht about her memoir, Thin Places. That's all coming up on today's Writer's Voice, in-depth conversation with writers of all genres, on the air since 2004. Thanks for joining us this hour on the station and at writersvoice.net. I'm host and producer Francesca Rhiannon. From tulsi to turmeric, echinacea to elderberry, medicinal herbs are big business. But do they deliver on their healing promise? The promise is made not only to those who consume them, but also to those who provide them. Using herbal medicines to heal the body is an ancient practice, but in the 21st century, it's also a worldwide industry. Yet most consumers know very little about where those herbs come from and how they're processed into the many products that fill store shelves. In The Business of Botanicals, author Ann Arbrecht follows their journey from seed to shelf, revealing the inner workings of a complicated industry, and she raises questions about the ethical and ecological issues of mass production of medicines derived from these healing plants, many of which are imperiled in the wild. The Business of Botanicals is the first book to explore the interconnected web of the global herb industry and its many stakeholders. It's an invaluable resource for conscious consumers who want to better understand the social and environmental impacts of the products they buy. The Boston Globe called The Business of Botanicals an eye-opener. Ann Arbrecht is an herbalist and the director of the Sustainable Herbs Program of the American Botanical Council. She's also the producer of the documentary Newman, which is about plants. We last spoke with Ann Arbrecht all the way back in 2009 about her first book, Thin Places. Later on, we'll play an excerpt from that interview. Ann Arbrecht, welcome to Writer's Voice.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
This book, The Business of Botanicals, you start the book by talking about how conflicted you are when you shop in a grocery store for supplements. Why are you conflicted?
Well, I'm sort of conflicted in general in grocery stores about all that I don't know about where products are from and whether they really, I care a lot about, like a lot of us, trying to make choices that are not just good for me and my health and my family's health, but for the health of the world. And it can be really hard to know that what we're buying in a grocery store is actually doing that. And so I have all those questions, and then I'm worried about the price and money. And so often I sort of just give up and leave empty-handed, especially in big stores. So, and then I think even more about supplements, because with herbal products, there's the promise we're told that they're better for us and better for the earth. And so the stakes are kind of higher. But again, how do you really know?
Yes, that really is the dilemma. It's funny. My mother was probably one of the first people in the entire country to be a Whole Foods person. And she almost consisted entirely on supplements for the last few years of her life. And I used to argue with her, you don't really know what you're getting. But let's get into that a little more, just a little bit. I want to introduce you a little bit more to our listeners. You're the director of the Sustainable Herbs Program of the American Botanical Council, and I'm asking more about that program later. You also produced a documentary, Newman, which is about plants, and you yourself became an herbalist after spending some time in Nepal. So talk to us a little bit about how you got into this whole field and what was the approach that you started with at the beginning?
Sure. Well, so, and I don't know if you remember, but years ago you interviewed me about my book, Thin Places, which was about the work in Nepal. And in that, which was a pilgrimage home, and the theme I was exploring in that book was how to be in relationship with the sacred or what's the beyond human world. And that really came alive for me in rural Nepal as I lived with villagers and was looking at their relationship with the land and their farming practices and the relationship that the priests and shamans had with the ancestors, the non-living, you know, the people who have come before them, and was struck by that sense of a relationship, not treating the environment as an object of resources to extract for our own use, but a give and take. You know, you offer rice in exchange for rain. You know, there was this sense of give and take, as well as the importance of culture kind of in that relationship with the environment. It wasn't just a transactional thing. And so those themes were really part of what I took from Nepal. And when I came home, I met Deb Sewell, and I write about this in The Business of Botanicals, an herbalist, and was really struck by her relationship with the plants and how she talked about them. And I found some of the kernels of what I'd experienced in Nepal in that, this sense of reciprocity in working with plants, a sense of spirit, that there was something unseen, you know, we call it spirit, that aliveness in that relationship, that again, it wasn't just chemicals that would change her physiology. It was something much more.
You know, what you've talked about already kind of shows us a difference, I think, between what we call allopathic or Western medicines and herbal medicines, but talk about the difference in how they actually work that really trades on this, you know, for herbal medicines, what you've already indicated, the sense of relationship. So how what's the difference between how allopathic and herbal medicines work, and what does that mean for how these medicines are processed?
How I study. So then I went on and I studied herbal medicine with Rosemary Gladstar and have been to conferences and others and learned more. And then we produced that film, Newman, to really explore exactly what you're asking, how herbs work. And so as sort of all natural medicine systems of the world work, it's one, it's really focused on the individual and rather than a collection of diseases that you get a single bullet, you know, pharmaceutical and plop it in and it has a direct action. The plants are a whole complex of chemicals. And so in the ideal scenario, an herbal practitioner really sits with the individual and listens to what's happening and then finds plants that meet the particular ways that those symptoms are expressing themselves in that individual. So it's the idea is that it's an individualized formula for that particular constitution. So that's part of it. And then it's also that the plants themselves are, because there's a mix of chemicals, the idea is that even though you can never maybe identify which chemical is responsible for which action, the idea is that they all kind of work together and balance things out. And so they're, depending on the language that the herbalist is talking about, it could, they create more dryness or cooling or heat. And so you want to balance that. And so again, the idea is it's not one single constituent having one single action, but as Matthew Wood told us in Newman, it's a nudge here and a nudge there.
So already I'm seeing a contradiction developing because you're talking about really almost kind of bespoke approach. That is, each person is unique in this. And yet We're talking about an herbal supplement industry in which you go to the store and you buy something off the shelf. There's no consultation with an herbalist, and half the time you don't even know what you're doing, what you're getting. You faced a key tension in doing this book because as you write in The Business of Botanicals, you did not set out to write an investigative exposé on the botanical industry. But that is some of what you found. I mean, almost half the book really is taken up with that, and the other kind of a little bit more than half, which is, you know, even more important perhaps, or is the other side of it, is about doing herbs the right way, where you go and you visit, you know, really model businesses that are doing it the right way. But it almost sounds, just to begin with, that, you know, how can you heal people if you don't know them and sit down and consult with them?
Right. And so there's so many sort of tensions and contradictions and all that you're touching on. So I'll get to that. But I want to talk first about the tension that immediately caught my attention, was that herbalists also talk about the relationship with the plant itself. So for them as a practitioner, or when they make medicine or a product with, say, bulk herbs that they've purchased, or the intention with meeting with the client and all of those things. And that intention, they say, is part of the healing. And yet they often would buy raw materials or finished products that have been bought and sold on a global supply, where there was none of that intention, or it would be really hard to see. I couldn't see that intention. And yet when I was studying herbal medicine, nobody was talking about that disconnect, that how you could have intention at the end of a long supply without having any idea about the steps along the way. So I really wanted to find out more about that. And then the first part of the question that you asked was really, you know, in making Newman, at the end of making that film and all the interviews we did, I became even so much more clear to me that to really use herbal medicine, you need to either study it or work with a practitioner, or, you know, because of that complexity. Otherwise, it is just this for that medicine, right? It's just you're taking a product off a shelf, you read, oh, this is going to help me in this way, elderberry. And it can work that way, right? I mean, you can take elderberry and it can boost your immune system and help perhaps reduce the symptoms of, you know, certain kinds of flus or something. So you can do it in that way. I think for more complex symptoms and conditions that you really need a practitioner. And that's been really threatened and undermined by the rise, especially of internet sales and all of that.
That's so interesting. You know, I can only say, compared to you, I dabble in making my own medicines. But I have found over the years that the only herbal medicines that really work for me are the ones I make myself, most often from plants that I've gathered or grown myself. And it sounds like, you know, even in my bumbling way, that intimate knowledge of where I'm sourcing my material and the act of creating the material, of making a tincture or making a salve, is what enhances the medicinal quality of it, even not just for me, but I've made medicines for my family, and they've worked quite well.
Well, and I love what you're saying, because I hadn't thought of it in exactly this way, but as you described, it's the whole, like all those chemicals in a plant, right? That's the healing. It's not just one chemical. In the same way, it's that whole nexus of things. It's collecting the plant, it's mixing it. That's all part of the healing. It's not just whatever that finished product is at the end.
Yes. You know, for example, my granddaughter had eczema when she was younger, and a salve that I made for her with marigolds worked really well, much better than what we'd gotten for her from the store. So I'll go on from there, because this is, you know, one of the things you say, Anne Armbrecht, in this book, The Business of Botanicals, is that it's an incredibly complex system, incredibly complex supply chain, distribution, production. And we won't have time to go into every aspect of it, but just to start off, So you went to an industrial herbal medicine production factory in Hoboken, New Jersey, and you found out, in fact, the sales director told you that there is intentional adulteration of raw materials, contaminants, in the supply from the Chinese, who, after all, supply probably a huge proportion of herbs to the herbal medicine industry. Tell us about that.
So as Joseph Brinkman, who is someone who I talk about a lot in the book, says, you can find every kind of herbs in China. You know, it's the biggest market. And some companies say they won't even source herbs from China because it can be so challenging to find high quality herbs that are actually what they say they are and have been produced in the way that they say they have been. There are companies that are sourcing directly and do have good relationships and have rigorous quality control. I think I came into this thinking small, local, homegrown medicine is the best medicine. And I do believe that for a family and household, it can be. When you leave that context of a garden and you don't know where things are coming from, I had assumptions about small scale being better scale. And as I went through this journey, I came to understand it was different from that. That was a wrong question, that it could be large scale or it could be small scale. It really depended on the attention and the quality of care that was being given each step of the way, that people were paying attention. And that gets back to the points before about the intention. You know, I had a lot of ideas about what intention looked like. And as I went on this journey, I realized intention shows up in different ways. It can be care for workers. It can be giving a contract to a farmer, a multi-year contract, rather than it can be not haggling for price all the time. These ways of having that reciprocal relationship, respecting the plants, respecting the people, that's going to bring quality into that raw material, that it's handled correctly, that it's not going to degrade and things like that. And sometimes when people are small scale and stressed and pressed on, and that can be in rural America or rural Poland, they're not going to be able to bring as much care to that quality of handling the herbs.
If you've just joined Writer's Voice, we're talking with Anne Armbrecht. Her book is The Business of Botanicals, Exploring the Healing Promise of Plant Medicines in a Global Industry. You have a wonderful little 6-minute video on your website in which, you know, some of the people that you talk to for the book speak. And I just would like to play a couple of moments from that.
We also realized early on that we couldn't reconcile making health products if the people who were harvesting the herbs were living in poverty or were not having their basic needs met. That didn't add up.
That's some of what you talked about. Tell us about your visit to Poland and the supply operation there. I mean, this is an example of one of the good supply operations. But, you know, it was, in reading about it, it was clear that it's not a simple thing. So tell us about that experience and what they're trying to do in this operation in Poland.
So when I first started this journey, it can be quite hard to go to what are producer groups. And a producer group would be where groups of collectors would bring the wild collected plants to a central facility where they're then processed. And processed means dried. And then the first stage of cutting the herbs and storage. So it can be quite hard to see into that. And because of secrecy and the history of secrecy and lack of transparency in the industry, I was able to visit some producer groups that are Fair Wild certified. And they were interested in having someone visit because they need to get more people paying attention to the certification. So they were happy for the, you know, any kind of storytelling. And so this facility in Poland was Fair Wild certified. And so in Poland, yes, it was really, there were so many, it was my first kind of visit to a manufacturing site. And before that, I'd been to the industrial facility in New Jersey, but that was different. That was like streamlined stainless steel, spotless. This was loud, noisy, dusty machines, huge amounts of herbs being, you know, stored in these warehouses as far as I could see.
We're starting really at the beginning of the supply chain here, which is the collecting. And we just heard, someone talk about the relationship to the workers. The workers who gather plants, even in good operations, are paid very little. They're at the bottom of the food chain, being at the bottom of the supply chain. Talk about the place that you went to in Poland, which is trying to implement something called the Fair Wild Standard. Explain that standard and what does it mean for collecting, both for the environment and the workers?
So no one has really accurate numbers of how much raw material, wild plants are harvested from the wild and on the market, but numbers go from anywhere to 60 to 90%. And a very small percentage of that is traced. That means they know where it comes from. There's some sense of accountability and understanding of how much is being overharvested or not, whether the plants are regenerating. So as Sebastian Pohl, who's a co-founder of Pukka Herbs, which is a big company that's a big supporter of Fair Wild, says, you don't go out if you don't know what's in your bank account. Like, you look in your bank account, and if you're running low, you say, oh, I'll stay home tonight. And with wild plants, there's no sense of how much is in that bank account. And so what Fair Wild is trying to do is it's a certification where it's mapped, the area's mapped, and there's resource assessments and all sorts of quite rigorous ecological surveying to really see how much is being taken, how much is regenerating, and sort of keeping track of that. So that's one part of it. It's the ecological impact part. And then the other is the fair part. And that's understanding that especially wild collectors make pennies, hardly anything, for the work they do. In the book, I quote, I think it was a thesis that found that 60% of the collectors in Bosnia would do something else if they had the option. So it's not a great way to make a living. And migration to urban areas and the loss of wild collection practices and the passing of that knowledge is one of the greatest threats to the long-term supply of botanicals from around the world. And so Fair Wild is one of the initiatives that's really trying to think, how do we make that livelihood better? And one way is by paying more. And so they do that in various ways, through a little bit more money per pound or kilo, and then also through a premium fund and really working to invest in the communities. And so the Polish project is a quite successful example of Fair Wild. And the things that struck me there, that was one of the first places I visited. And I went there looking for plants. But what caught my attention were the people. And those were, even in this short visit, I felt this real exchange and a connection between me and all of the people I met. There was this kindness and care. And later at the end of the book, when I'm talking about when I was at an Indian Ayurvedic center, and we were talking about cleanliness and different standards of cleanliness. And again, I went in with these ideas of spotlessness being clean. And so Poland was a little surprising because it was quite dusty and not dirty, but dusty. And, machines were kind of run down. And this Ayurvedic practitioner said, but I said the people were so kind and there was so much heart in this company in Poland. And he said, yeah, there's cleanliness as in dirt, the absence of dirt, and there's cleanliness as clean hearts.
And that goes very much to, something I think you've already referred to, but that really is such a central thesis of your book. And that is that the key issue, the key ingredient is creating relationship. And I'd just like to play something else from some of the people you interviewed.
At the heart of what we do is our relationship with the plants, because that's what inspires us, and we take great pride and joy in delivering and serving people with what we could consider to be the best quality herbs.
So it's not just a case of coming here and saying, right, we want to buy this and we want to buy that. It's like, okay, what are we going to do in the next 3 to 5 years? And we're going to do it together. The supplier or the partner needs to have that total trust that we're with them in the long term. Otherwise, they're not going to do it.
Buying herbs, it's about helping contribute to people improving their lives. And that might be through a cup of tea or a nice herbal supplement if you're a customer, or through a farmer, it's through being able for them to be able to plan on their future as well.
So talk about what are some of the ways in which this Fair Wild Standard is giving back to communities.
Well, first, I want to thank you so much for listening and sharing those video clips. I love that video. And when I've watched it again recently, it made me love it even more. And I think it's, I might not exactly answer your question around how Fair Wild is giving back, but what has stayed with me and what continues to stay with me in my work is that connection between, you know, the voices that you heard there, Sebastian Pohl, Ben Heron. There's so many people involved in sourcing, and most of them are in the sourcing the Fair Wild, because that does involve much more investment and time and commitment. I mean, Ben, whom I talk about later in the Fair Wild, the chapter focusing on the Fair Wild project in India, he called it a hungry beast. You know, the work of really bringing this, helping this community get the skills needed to do the resource inventories and to just meet the rigorous requirements of this certification, which, you know, is a challenging thing, right? Because we're, you know, Westerners coming in and saying, can you, we'll buy your product, but can you meet these standards that we have set? And so I think the success of something like that really depends on how it's implemented, and that it's not just us coming in, meet these standards, but really partnering. And I talk about in that chapter, and Ben talks about how that unfolded in the case in India. And so the learning that was happening in this village, this is in the northwestern Ghats, and how they directed like the steps of the process in ways that Ben learned from. And so direct ways that the community benefits are, you know, the premium fund that they invest in different ways. But I also think how they benefit is in these ways that also going back to the plants being complex chemicals, it's not just one benefit. It's not just more money. It's that they're getting skills that they didn't have before, that regardless of whether they stay in this Fair Wild project, they take those skills with them around data management, around tracking complex, you know, resource inventory, around machines. They're learning these skills. They're also understanding their place in this global supply. Before, they thought that the Harataki fruit that they were harvesting was used, and it often has been used in the tanning industry, but the Harataki they're growing is used for triphala. And triphala is one of the most well-known Ayurvedic remedies. And the people that we spoke with all talked about how knowing that shifted their care. But also it gives them a different sense of the work they're doing. You know, if you're creating medicine, that feels a little better than if you're just creating something for the tanning industry. And then another outcome of this project is that they've gotten legal ownership of their trees. They always had that ownership in a traditional way, but because of the requirements for the certification, now it's legal. So they have that tree in an ownership's way, which is also an outcome that's not the direct intention of the project.
Well, that's really beautiful. Tying together those correspondences between the plant and the way this project is happening in India. Anne Armbrecht speaking with us about her book, The Business of Botanicals. Stay tuned for more of our conversation after the break. Welcome back to Writer's Voice. I'm Francesca Rhiannon. Sign up for the free Writer's Voice podcast and weekly newsletter at writersvoice.net. You can find more great content there, including web-only features like book recommendations and extended interviews. Now let's get back to my conversation with Anne Armbrecht about her book, The Business of Botanicals. So you mentioned the word standards, and, you know, I remember back in the, mid-90s, when I would shop at Whole Foods, which was before it was owned by Amazon, by the way, there was a lot of advertisement there about this law, the DSHEA, is that right?
Yeah, it's called DSHEA.
DSHEA, and, you know, about attempts to control, to prevent herbs from being marketed, which, of course, you know, people who, like me who shopped at Whole Foods didn't want to have happen. But on the other hand, you know, it is hard. These herbal medicines don't have the same kind of standards as allopathic medicines. So I was a little, you know, I was a little conflicted myself. So explain the DSHEA and, you know, what have been the good points, but also some of the unintended consequences of it.
Right. So one of the hardest chapters to write in this book was chapter 4, where I talk about DSHEA. I mean, the whole book was really hard to write, but that chapter especially, because as many times as I was read about DSHEA, I still just like can't fully understand that sort of the regulatory framework. And I also remember, you know, going into, I was in Cambridge, Mass at the time, and there was a herb store, and same, there was all those signs, sign this, and I signed them all, like, don't give away your rights for freedom of access. Essentially, what DSHEA did is, before DSHEA passed, and I think it was right, 95 or 96, herb companies faced risk of being closed by the FDA because for regulatory things, because they were illegal. And so lots of people I talked to and people who have been interviewed, I saw a series of interviews about that time, and they all expressed this real fear they faced as company owners, that they had no idea about the legal status of their company.
And why? Explain why they were illegal.
Because of how herbs were regulated, and I'm going to need to look to...
I mean, I think the issue was that they had herbs, you know, been around for millennia. They were not; they are not products that were created in a lab and subjected to, you know, many years of testing and then approval by the FDA. So any kind of claims about health claims that could be made about herbs, you know, would be subject to the FDA coming in and say, you can't make these claims and you have to shut this down.
Yes. So DSHEA allowed companies, it gave them a legal framework. They could sell their products under as a food rather than having to go through drug, you know, claims to become a drug. And so it opened the market. And suddenly there was this rush of all sorts of companies getting in to make a buck. Before, the companies tended to be started by herbalists and practitioners and things like that who really understood the plants and plant medicine. But then the floodgates opened, and it had all sorts of impacts. One, it freed up companies, the good quality companies, to do their work. But it also brought in a whole lot of shady operators with questionable quality control standards that led to a huge, huge range in quality. And so the US is really known in the market, in the global market, as the price buying industry where cheap herbs could be sold because there was not that rigorous quality control. And that was because of two things. One, because after the 1930s, there had been this really strong tradition of pharmacology, you know, the studying science of herbal medicine in the US. And that really died out as allopathic medicine took over in the 40s, 50s, and 60s. Whereas in other countries, Europe, India, China, that didn't happen. And so they had this history of high quality standards, understanding, knowledge, And so they kept the high quality herbs there because they knew how to find them and they knew what that meant. In the US, that was lost and it did become organized around price. And that took so long to sort of begin being addressed because the good manufacturing practices, it took the FDA almost 10 years, I think, to implement standards for how herbs were sourced and manufactured so that there was some regulation and some guidelines around that. Another unintended consequence was a huge impact on sourcing. And then I tell some stories about that in the book, just over-harvesting, gathering echinacea from along the highways in the Midwest and things like that.
Yeah. I mean, in fact, you say that the U.S. gets like the, you know, there are three categories of herb quality, 1, 2, and 3, with 3 being the worst. And that's what ends up in the U.S.
And that is, you know, since I started this book until now, I mean, I started this book a long time ago. It's taken me a long, long time. So last 10 years, that is changing in the U.S. And it's in part changing because of this program at American Botanical Council, where I now work, the adulterants program, which is an interesting initiative led by the industry to address, it's like self-policing of the industry to look, okay, this is where, you know, back to your point about China and adulteration, to identify plants that have a particularly high chance of being adulterated. So that's one thing, what to look out for. And then there are certain companies that then develop ways to get around the labs. So they'll create something synthetic, say, that can get around the typical lab testing to identify the adulteration. And so it's not only identifying the adulteration, it's identifying ways to catch the adulteration.
Wow. And what's the name of that program?
Botanical Adulterate Prevention Program. And you know, the bigger and more important point is that people talk about the botanical industry, and I am totally guilty of that, but that there's a huge range of quality. As my boss, Mark Blumenthal, says, there are people with really rigorous quality control, you know, people who really care. There are people who care because that's what they need to do to stay in business, and they understand that. And then there are people that aren't even in the room of quality control. And then the thing I'm trying to explore in this book is to say that caring about sustainability is really connected with that. And that's that quotation that from that first video clip that you shared, you know, Joseph Brinkman, who's saying quality has to be connected to the quality of care of the people. You know, if they're not living a dignified life, not only in an ethical way, but also if you're exhausted and tired and sleeping under a tin roof, you're not going to pay attention to how you care for drying herbs that you're going to sell for not much money. So really trying to make those connections.
If you've just joined Writer's Voice, we're talking with Anne Armbrecht. Her book is The Business of Botanicals, Exploring the Healing Promise of Plant Medicines in a Global Industry. Right. You may not even gather, you know, the right part of the plant affect the, you know, to have a medicinal effect. But then the other aspect, though, I mean, I've seen, you know, estimates when studies have been done on supplements, not just herbal, but also vitamin supplements, you know, that show oftentimes, you know, the amount of the active ingredient is very low or non-existent, or there may be other ingredients in there that really have nothing, that are nothing to do with healing, that you don't really know what you're getting. I remember with my mother, you know, who I said practically lived on supplements, is I gave her as a gift a subscription to something, I think it's called Consumer Lab. It's a website where they do testing of herbal products and they'll tell you what are the good ones and what are not. What are some resources that people who are concerned about this, who take herbal supplements, where can they go to find out whether what they're buying is what they intend to buy?
I just want to say what you're saying reminds me of this story that sort of first, you know, this whole world of supplements was so foreign to me, coming kind of from studying herbal medicine in a yurt at Rosemary Gladstar's in northeastern Vermont. And when I was at this clinic free clinic run by herbalists, and this man came in and just unloaded all this backpack filled with these supplements to help him address his symptoms. And the herbalist who he was meeting with said, stop taking all those supplements and here's some tea. You know, because I think and that's one of the big questions I'm asking in this book, is such a focus on the products and more and this and that. And again, the people in the industry who I've gotten to know, they don't take a lot of products. They take a few and they make sure the ones they take are the highest quality they can afford. And that's another key issue I feel like is not talked about enough, is herbal products are expensive and high quality ones are expensive. So I'm going to put that on the side for a second and get back to your question around how to find good information. So people often ask me what companies to buy from, and I kind of resist answering that, even though I also want to ask people that question myself. So I'll answer it, but I'm going to also say why I resist it. Back to the points you were saying about when you grow and harvest and make medicine and how potent that is. What drew me to herbal medicine in the first place was how empowering I felt. Like finally I could grow something and make something to help my daughter's earache feel better, you know, or I could make her nettle tea and feel like I was giving her this charge of nutrients or something. And I didn't need a doctor for that. And that was great and empowering and very satisfying in the way growing your own food is satisfying. And I feel like that empowerment is completely lost when we're just standing in the supplement aisle, like, you know, what do I buy? What company do I buy? And so I try and think, okay, how could figuring out what company you want to support be part of that same process of like, so you can't grow your own herbs, but you can learn about how a company's growing their herbs or sourcing their herbs to sort of engage in a partnership with that particular company. So that's what I feel like is ultimately a more empowering way to be not just a consumer of herbal products, but really something deeper. And for companies though, because we all want companies to know when we're standing there, so on the Sustainable Herbs Program website, we have donors and the people who have supported the Sustainable Herbs Program. We're not saying they're necessarily doing all of what they claim around sustainability, but they are making a significant investment contribution to support initiatives to raise awareness about sustainability, which is connected with quality. So that's one way. There's some brands on that website. And then in my book, the companies I follow, you know, I follow Traditional Medicinals and Pukka Herbs, and I visited others, Herb Farm, Gaia Herbs, Herbalist Alchemist. Those are, you know, and there's others, plenty. The first one I visited, you know, Avena Botanicals, Woodland Essence, companies that are run by herbalists in your region are good ways to start. But nobody's going to list buy from these companies, because that, you know, there's things you can look at on labels. So buying certified organic is a way of ensuring that there has to be a paper trail to the source. And that's a way of getting that transparency.
Well, that's great. You know, I'd like to end with something that you say here. You quote Wendell Berry saying that we live on the far side of a broken connection. And so much of this book is about repairing that connection. I'm going to play one more thing from your 6-minute video and just have you talk about that.
We've been hoodwinked about how our world can survive in a sustainable way, in the way we're living, and we're the generation that are responsible for helping change that, basically. It's all about love. What do you love? And who do you love? And how do you want to love them? And if you love nature, and you love people, you want to take care of them.
So, it's all about love.
I love that.
Well, this has just been really great. You know, we've barely touched the surface. This is I think the value of this book, The Business of Botanicals, is that you take nothing for granted. You're willing to explore all your assumptions and your preconceived notions. You delve into the complexity of the issues here. Yes, there are bad actors. Yes, there are good actors. But also, there's really a system that, you know, overall system. And I think you put your finger on it, the capitalist system, you know, the drive for profits, that is always breaking that connection between us and our medicines, our plants, our earth. And I think the value of your book is how you create this really informed whole. And I can imagine this was a really difficult book to write because it's an honest book. And I want to thank you, Anne Arbrecht, for talking with us here on Writer's Voice about The Business of Botanicals.
Thank you so much. And thank you for that way of just saying the capitalism is breaking that connection, because it helps me see that what I'm trying to say is explore is how can we connect within that? Is that possible? And if so, where? And what do we need? And how can we all wake up to that? And it was the hardest book I've ever written.
And thank you for writing it.
Thanks so much.
Go to writersvoice.net for links to some short videos connected to the people featured in Anne Arnbrecht's book, The Business of Botanicals. And now let's listen to a short excerpt from my 2009 interview with Anne Arnbrecht about her book, Thin Places, A Pilgrimage Home. When Anne Arnbrecht went to a small village in Nepal to research her dissertation in anthropology, she thought she would find answers to her questions about Nepalese land rights. But she also found answers to questions in her own life, questions about community, relationships, and trust. Through her friendships with women in the village in Nepal where she went, Arnbrecht learned to see beyond the narrow confines of cultural expectations to the common bonds between human beings. She worked in the fields beside the women, she talked to the shamans about the spirit world, and she went on a grueling pilgrimage to a cave high in the Himalayan mountains. But her real pilgrimage was toward the center of the human heart. In this excerpt from our interview about her memoir, Thin Places, she tells us about developing the connections with the women in the village in Nepal.
Everybody would look at me very suspiciously and ask why I wanted to know who lived in the house and what I was going to do with this information, and was I going to take their names back to the United States with me. And then they would say, really, they had no time. They had to go to the fields to work, and maybe their neighbors would talk to me. And so I decided that the best thing to do was just go with them in the fields and help them out there. And that worked much better over time as I got to know some people well. That then built more trust, and I was more a person and less a strange curiosity.
Now, you spoke Nepali, but you didn't speak the native language of the people in the village.
Right.
What kind of impact did that have on your ability to communicate with them?
That was one of the hardest parts. And in the beginning, I tried to learn Yakuba, which is their local language, which is spoken by, you know, 2,000 or 3,000 people in the world, and it's an oral language. With the men, it was never a significant problem in my research, because most men either had been to school or they needed to know Nepali and be fluent in Nepali in order to deal with things like taxation and land tenure and land disputes and any interaction with the Nepalese government. They needed Nepali, so they all could speak fine in Nepali. With the women, it was harder, because especially those who had never left the village and never been to school, they could speak Nepali, but it wasn't their first choice, and it was more broken. And so we'd have conversations in Nepali, and I think probably each of us, you know, I have no idea how much each of us actually understood about what we were talking about. And that was with some of the older women, mostly. Younger women who are going to school more could speak Nepali fine.
But you became pretty close with people, even with an older woman, a grandmother.
Yes.
Talk about that closeness. What had to happen with you? I mean, they must have changed and your relationship changed, but did something in you change also that enabled you to bridge the distance?
That's a good question. I think as I became more relaxed about understanding just what I could understand with words, and then this grandmother would, when I would come back to the village after I'd been away, she would come right over and grab my hands and dance with me around in the mud courtyard and chant this sort of very sing-songy chant. And other times I'd go to her house to see her and we'd sit with one candle that I would bring because she didn't have any kerosene. She didn't have money to buy kerosene for a light. And she would tell me these stories and I would take as much from her animation and her gestures and her facial expressions as I would from her actual words. And so in an anthropological sense, like what I would write up about that encounter, it wasn't so much about that gathering research information and more just this connection with her. I hesitate to use the word friendship, but just an opening for both of us, I think, and reaching across.
Now, why do you hesitate to use the word friendship?
I think Himali, whom I called Devi Maya in the book, who's a younger woman in her 20s, and Raj Kumar, who is a younger man who had lived for a year or two in Kathmandu and helped me some with my research. I think with them I would call friends. I think with friendship, is there an exchange? I don't know. I don't know if I can answer that question.
Well, let me ask it in a different way then. You know, there's this kind of central tenet of anthropology that the anthropologist is not supposed to go native, so to speak. First, could you tell us what does that mean and what do you think of that idea?
Mm-hmm. I think the fear of going native. What it's like losing, in anthropology, the main way you get research is participant observation. And so it's going native when you lose the observer stance and you're just completely participating and losing. But it's not just that, I haven't thought about this question in so long. It's giving up your own cultural, who you are and where you come from, and just taking on another set of beliefs and practices that aren't coming from your own cultural tradition, where you're from, losing that grounding, I think. And so then the second part of your question was what I thought of that.
Yeah.
It's interesting, when I went back to Nepal, I think part of the fear of going native is, you know, there's a tension in anthropology about having an impact in the community where you live. You know, if you're a participant in observation, you participate, but you're always on the outside somehow, and you don't want to change the community, or that was the sort of expectation passed down. And of course that's changing, and anthropologists don't expect that that's the case, because every encounter leads to some shift or transformation. But I think this fear of going native. It's maybe in me because I went to Nepal looking to find out about land tenure and their experience and perceptions of this conservation project, but also really looking for questions, answers to questions I had in my own life. And I think, so maybe I was particularly aware of my own version of what it would mean to go native, which would be embracing some answer to a question that wasn't, I'm not answering this very well.
You're doing fine.
Fear of giving up who I was as an American. And maybe I was especially prone to that, so I was more aware of it. Even as the last time I went back to Hiranga, and I talk about this in the book, Devi Maya's fiancé had been killed a few weeks before I came. And so I gave up trying to do any sort of research and just was there as a friend, and or tried to be there in whatever way I thought could offer her some comfort. And yeah, I'm at an end point there.
That was Anne Armbrecht talking with us in 2009 about her memoir, Thin Places, A Pilgrimage Home. Go to writersvoice.net to hear the rest of that interview. And last week, we said we were also going to talk this week with Jenny Romer about her book, Can I Recycle This? We ran out of space to give that interview justice, so we'll be airing it soon. That's it this week for Writer's Voice. Go to writersvoice.net to listen to or download past shows, plus find out more about our guests or read book excerpts. You can also sign up to get the show delivered straight to your inbox or subscribe to the podcast and the newsletter. And follow us on Twitter at Writer's Voice, all one word. I'm your host, Francesca Rhiannon.